Welcome to the France 24 debate, a lead conversation between Trump envoy Steve Witkoff and Putin's foreign policy aide Yuri Ushakov has had an incendiary effect on the Ukraine peace plan, a plan that read like it had been written by the Kremlin, the call for Ukraine to surrender land, cut back its military and give up any notion of NATO membership, the list is endless, was already raising worried eyebrows. In the light of a recorded phone call between Witkoff and Ushakov, the concern about the closeness of the Trump administration to Putin and the Kremlin has hit a point of alarm. We'll be meeting our guests after this report from Florent Marché.
Was U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff working behind the scenes with a top Putin advisor to set up a peace deal for Ukraine a month before it was announced? Yesterday, U.S. media outlet Bloomberg published a transcript of a call from mid-October between Witkoff and a senior aide to Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, because listen to what I'm saying. I just want you to say, maybe just say this to President Putin because you know I have the deepest respect for President Putin.
Yes, yes.
Maybe he says to President Trump, you know, Steve and Yuri discussed a very similar 20-point plan to peace that could be something that we think might move the needle a little bit. We're open to those sorts of things, to explore what it's going to take to get a peace deal done. Now, me to you, I know what it's going to take to get a peace deal done. Donetsk and maybe a land swap somewhere.
Media outlets have stated that Witkoff appeared to be advising Putin's aide Yuri Ushakov on how to pitch a deal that Trump would be willing to back. In the transcript, Witkoff also asked Ushakov to tell Putin to flatter Trump with praise for the Gaza ceasefire agreement and to plan a call between the two presidents before a visit by Vladimir Zelensky to Washington. Last week, the initial draft of the U.S.'s 28-point peace plan for Ukraine was widely considered by European allies and independent analysts to be aligned with Russia's major demands. On Tuesday, Trump was questioned by journalists about the leaked transcript on Air Force One.
Have you heard this audio that Bloomberg has of Witkoff coaching the Russians on how to appeal to you?
That's a standard thing, you know, because he's going to sell this to Ukraine. He's going to sell Ukraine to Russia. That's what a deal maker does.
For its part, the Kremlin has called the leaked transcript an attempt to hinder a possible peace deal for Ukraine.
Florent Marché setting us up for this debate. Let's introduce our guests to discuss the matters. Here in the studio, Anastasia Shaposhkina of the Eastern Circles think tank. Anastasia, thank you very much for being with us. On the opposite side of the studio, not necessarily against, but of course time will tell as we go through. Samantha Debenden, who's an associate fellow at Chatham House. Samantha, always a privilege to see you. Joining us from Geneva is Boris Bondarev, a former Russian diplomat. Boris, thank you for being with us, sir. You'll get a chance to have your say in a moment. I'm letting it loose in the studio first before we come to you. So thank you for being with us. Bear with us. You'll be on in a moment's time. Starting here in the studio, Anastasia, were you... I mean, I think what we've heard, Witkoff talking with his Russian counterpart, in a sense, setting this up for Russian success. Some people might have been shocked by that. Some people may not have been shocked by that. What was your reaction?
My reaction was very simple, of the two real estate agents from New York City discovering Russian diplomacy 101. That was my reaction to the so-called 28-point plan, which was a ditto of the Russian ultimatum of December 2021. It was my reaction also to this so-called coaching, as if after working on Trump for last 40 years, the Russians needed any coaching on how to work on Trump. And I would really be careful if I were Mr. Witkoff with the expressions such as a land swap somewhere, because it doesn't take long a historian such as Vladimir Putin to remember that Alaska and California were undersold and sold at a big discount to America in its time, their time, and that Americans have never even paid that money in full.
That is an interesting thing to add in terms of land somewhere. I mean, obviously, where that goes next is a different matter, but Ukraine clearly is what we're looking at right now. Samantha, can I bring you in there? The art of the deal is what we call this in our selling of the debate. Some say it's a sellout. Your take on it? Out of the deal or?
Out of the steel.
Out of the steel, I think is probably a very good way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't surprised by the contents of the transcript. I've been studying Witkoff for quite a while. I wrote an article about him a few months ago, detailing his relationships with Russians in New York, including members of the Russian underworld. He wrote a recommendation at some point for a Russian real estate magnate who was afterwards imprisoned for embezzlement and smuggling, who was linked to the Russian mafia in New York.
Anatoly Golubchik.
Anatoly Golubchik, yeah. who was also linked to an organized crime syndicate called an organized crime boss called Tyvanchik, who had offices in Trump Tower, by the way.
Okay.
So none of this was surprising. What I find really interesting in this story is who leaked the transcript and why. And I think if it was the Americans, which it could have been, who are the only ones with the Russians who would really have access to the information and the ability to leak it, that would indicate there's a lot of dissatisfaction in American security services, whether it's the NSA, whether it's the CIA, whether it's other agencies, with the way things are going. I don't really see Russians leaking it, because I don't think they have a lot to gain unless it's to make Witkoff look like an idiot. But I think that it's the fact that Witkoff is behaving like an idiot, whether he is or not is another question. He could just be pretending to be. I think this is actually, you know, win-win for the Russians. So it looks as though the Americans probably leaked this, and who and why is the most interesting aspect of this whole affair from my point of view.
We will get through to that in a moment. Samantha, thanks for that opening. Salvo, let's bring in Boris Bondarev, who's in Geneva. Boris is a former Russian diplomat. Boris, tell us more about your background, sir, because I think I've perhaps undersold you with that one remark.
Well, I've been with the MFA of Russia for 20 years, mostly non-proliferation and strategic stability.
And so what is your sense of what we're seeing right now? Yeah. Are we seeing, in some way, shape or form, the art of the deal? Witkoff perhaps negotiating in some way to get the kind of deal that is required? Or is something else going on, something more dark, especially for Ukraine?
Well, I think it may be dark for Ukraine, but I think we shouldn't forget that the main goal of Witkoff, as he is instructed by President Trump, is not to reconcile Russia and Ukraine. The main goal of Trump-Russia policy is to restore Russian-American relations to its previous level. So back to business as usual. And peaceful settlement of Ukrainian war is a necessary step to that. So Witkoff is doing whatever he can to improve relations with Russia. That's totally, well, it can be explained. His dialogue with Yuri Ushakov, when he tries to advise him how Vladimir Putin should approach Donald Trump in this phone call, so it all goes smoothly, that's natural, and that's okay. And that is one thing where I cannot criticize Witkoff for his being diplomat once. Yeah, that is the entire strategy, the entire concept of restoring relations between Russia and the United States to its previous, before Crimea level or something like that, which I find personally wrong and not possible, not feasible in the current circumstances. But that's a different question. What we hear from this conversation, from this leak, I don't find anything that we should, you know, where we can find Witkoff guilty. Because he's not obliged to, you know, to make something good for Ukraine. He's obliged to make good for his patron, Donald Trump, and he's doing his best.
So Witkoff just doing his job as Donald Trump's envoy. And of course, as you point out, Boris, that's something that it's his remit to do that. And maybe we're a little bit too, I don't know, naive to be shocked by what has gone on. We'll continue more with that in a moment. Boris Bondarev in Geneva, thank you very much indeed. Let's come back to the studio where we have Anastasia Shabushkina and Samantha DeBenden to talk more about the situation. Donald Trump on Air Force One talking about this is just something that people do in negotiations. Witkoff negotiates with Russia and then it'll be put to Ukraine. That was kind of misleading, wasn't it? Because the narrative so far has been, this is what Russia can ask for and demand, and Ukraine will have to accept this, as Donald Trump said, or he leaves Zelensky to fight his own little heart out on the way by himself.
It is an interesting question why the US hasn't just done that already, because indeed nothing prevents the US just to go and restore that relationship as it is desiring to do, and in a continuation of this kind of U-turn toward kind of total disregard for the international law and a redrawing of the U.S. priorities geopolitically, right? But what helped, I think, Ukrainians a lot in Geneva is the presence and the help of the European leaders, so France, Germany, and the U.K. And that has shift the discussion from the Russian conditions, you know, dating to just before the war, to the kind of a more Ukrainian position, to including some Ukrainian positions, including the position which would allow Ukraine to negotiate for a NATO, entering NATO, joining NATO sometime in the future, potentially when the US changes its position, because now the US is opposed to it. It allowed Ukraine to increase the number of the army at peace, which I think in any case would be potentially the maximum that Ukraine would be able to maintain in peace, and also that any economy would be able to maintain in peacetime. And it changed the conditions for Ukrainian arms industry and arms production, which is really key both to Ukrainian current capacity to maintain the defense and to its future, that everybody understands. It's not on relying on foreign deliveries that it's going to be able to improve its defense chances. These are important changes. However, for me, what's surprising, I just wanted to build upon what Samantha was saying. The surprise to me is that we are discussing yet another peace deal, as if this is the ultimate peace deal. But the only reason we're discussing it as the ultimate thing is because it is so phrased by Russia. Yet again, if you remember, this, I'm sure, because this has been, you know, on air, the word negotiation appeared during a first successful counter-offensive that Ukraine was leading in October 2022. Since then, we hear the word negotiation and peace deal nonstop. So why are we pausing, putting aside our coffee and reading this as if this was the Bible? That is what's surprising to me. Because Russia is just trying to win time.
And as always, it's Ukraine that has to make the concessions, and everything seems to be going in Russia's way. But it's Russia that's the aggressor, which is the thing which I think maybe many people, Samantha, find hard to really reconcile with. Unless, of course, they don't care about that and they just care about the transaction happening and reestablishing relations between Russia and the US.
No, the shocking thing about the whole way the US have been negotiating since Trump came to power is that they seem to be very clearly taking a pro-Russian line on this. And I would disagree slightly with Yuri Bondarev about saying that Witkoff has done nothing wrong. If the Russian intelligence agencies wanted to position themselves to know how to get Trump in the best possible place, they would need somebody who can give them little keys to how to understand Trump. They would need somebody to tell them what they need to do to put Trump in the place where they can do what they want with him. And that is exactly what Witkoff has done. I would argue that Witkoff could be a guilty of treason in the way he was giving information to the Russians on how to negotiate with his own president to get what they want, not to get what his president wants, but to get what they want. They were giving them keys for their success. Now, if America is negotiating, even if it were a mediator would be giving equal attention to both parties. America likes to pretend that it's a mediator. It seems to forget that it's part of an alliance that has aligned itself with Ukraine. And if you look at point four of the famous 28-point deal, in which America says that there will be a dialogue between NATO and the Russian Federation on Europe's security architecture mediated by the United States. Here again, you have the United States trying to position themselves outside of NATO even. Okay, let's say they want to do that. They do not give preferential treatment to one of the parties in this deal. So for me, we always suspected that the Americans were being very pro-Russian. We've seen, you know, Witkoff go to Moscow, meet with Putin without even a U.S. embassy interpreter, but the Kremlin's interpreter. Witkoff coming back and going on Tucker Carlson's show saying that he likes Putin, although he's unable to mention the four oblasts that have been incorporated into the Russian Federation by the Russians. So I actually find this is shocking. And Witkoff, if any other advisor of a European or an international head of state were caught giving that kind of sensitive information to a foreign leader, they would be arrested for treason. So I'm sorry, just because you're trying to get a good outcome in a negotiation does not allow you to spill the beans and give keys to your opponent. And this is where I would like to come to the whole idea of a negotiation. You know, negotiation is usually between two parties who want to achieve something. There is no negotiation today between the Russians and the Ukrainians. There's a negotiation between the Ukrainians and the Americans, between the Americans and the Russians, between the Europeans and themselves. But the day the Russians and the Ukrainians negotiate and really start putting cards on the table, and when the Russians stop pretending to negotiate, but actually really negotiate, which we haven't actually seen since 2022, we've just seen ultimatums being thrown on the table, then maybe something will start to happen and we can really talk about negotiations. But yeah, so for now, I think that there's a lot of talk, a lot of interesting information being revealed. And as Europeans, we have to realize that we are more and more on our own in this big, wide world.
Indeed, the surreal recording of Witkoff briefing Putin's envoy, Yuri Ushakov, of course, has sent shockwaves across many newsrooms, many places across Europe, wondering what happens next. Let's bring in Boris Bondarev, who is the former Russian diplomat, joining us from Geneva. Boris, this situation, as you pointed out earlier, Witkoff doing what is seen as his role, Samantha pointing out that what he's doing could be seen in some level as treasonous betrayal, certainly of an alliance, and certainly it's doing no favors for Ukraine.
Well, first of all, this phone call took place in October, right?
Yes.
Donald Trump had been the president of the United States by the time for about 9 months or something.
Correct.
I believe that it was worldwide known in that time how to reach his heart. Flattery, flattery, flattery. Yeah, Donald Trump is to be flattered all the times. And so it's no secret. What Witkoff told Ushakov, that President Putin must praise Trump, must flatter him somehow, it's no big deal. It's no secret. Yeah, so I don't think that Russians didn't know that before, and it was some kind of a huge discovery for them. So the more important thing that Witkoff proposed that Putin make this phone call before President Zelensky visited the Oval Office. That was much more important insight, and that played a role in making this Budapest summit plans and something that could have really derailed and much derailed and damaged Ukrainian position. Yes. So, but Witkoff, in my opinion, Witkoff has no concerns about Ukraine. It's not his concern. He wants to make this peace deal for Trump at whatever cost, Russian, preferably Ukrainian cost, less Russian maybe, but still peace deal for Donald Trump. So Donald Trump could report to the world that I am a great peacemaker and all. That's it. And Steve Witkoff, being not a professional diplomat, he doesn't have enough, you know, knowledge and professional experience. I think he's looking at what he must do in a very narrow way. He sees only Russia, only the Kremlin. He knows that he must approach them, and make them like more flexible to his approach, but he doesn't include into his calculations Europe, Ukraine much, and he doesn't think about consequences that all his steps can have in future for European security, for Ukraine, of course, and for United States.
Boris Bondarev, for now, thank you very much indeed. Please stay with us. We'll get back to you as soon as we can. Good news to announce. We have another guest who's been able to join us. So let's introduce James Townsend, former Deputy Assistant to the U.S. Secretary of Defense, regarding European and NATO policy. James, thank you for joining us. Mr. Townsend, sir, you've had a chance to listen to what the guests have been saying so far. Anastasia Shaposhkina of Eastern Circles, Samantha Dependon of Chatham House, and of course, Boris Bondarev, former Russian diplomat. I'll start you off by asking you what I asked our guests at the beginning of this. Were you shocked by Witkoff's antics?
Well, I was disappointed, certainly. I think we were certainly surprised, a number of us here in Washington and our community that follows this every minute of the day, we were surprised that he hadn't gotten smarter, if you will, over time, and more concerned about not being taken in, that he seemed to not have had any savvy brought on by his experience over the past couple of months, both dealing with diplomats from Europe and as well as, I would hope, maybe talking to some people in the State Department, but certainly working with the Russians and understanding that he has to be careful here. But I think what my Russian colleague just said, I found that compelling. I think he's right. I think Witkoff does have a very narrow view. He is got one audience in mind, and that's Trump. Trump has told him, go to Moscow, see what you can do, base it on what we did in Gaza. Let's have a Gaza-like draft that we can show the Russians. And so that was truly his focus. He wasn't so much caring about Europe and even Ukraine. I think his focus really was trying to get a document that he can then take back to Trump and then have Trump introduce it to Zelensky. But what happened was you had all these leaks, certainly the leak of the document to begin with, and it set off a firestorm in Washington particularly, as well as within the administration. There's a lot of infighting happening now within the administration. And so the European nations got involved early on to try to save the day, coming up with a draft that they felt would work. And so then in Geneva, you have Marco Rubio, like the cavalry, coming in and trying to put this negotiation on the right footing. So I think it's really, for me, it's frustration and it's disappointment that we're still having Witkoff be the main negotiator. And he just hasn't learned on the job, if you will, some savvy on how to do this, not just in terms of working with Russia, but in terms of process, that you can't go off and be a one-man band, if you will, as we say in the U.S., and running around thinking that he alone is going to be able to carry the day and win it for Trump. There's a process. There are others like Marco Rubio. There's the Europeans that he has got to keep in mind. And so I think my Russian colleague, I think you spelled it out very well. It's frustrating and it's disappointing.
But James, are you concerned that what is happening here isn't an art of the deal scenario, but perhaps a sellout of Ukraine?
Well, if this deal goes wrong and sour and something is rammed down Zelensky's throat that does nothing to ensure their security, that looks after their dignity in terms of how they end up at the end of a peace process, and doesn't take security of Europe into account, then this is a sellout. Then this is a disaster of an agreement. I'm hoping that that's not where we're going to go with this agreement. A lot will depend on Russia. But I do think when you mentioned the art, is this the art of the deal? We do, and I think some of my colleagues around the panel have said some of this, but we are dealing with the art of the deal as practiced by businessmen, as practiced by in the real estate community in Manhattan, where someone like Witkoff, maybe he runs around and he is a free spirit, if you will, a free electron, and he's bouncing from a Russian to Russian to Jared Kushner, who's also a real estate person. And their art of the deal is practiced in a way that might be familiar to real estate people in Manhattan. But to all of us on the outside who are used to diplomatic process, who are used to dealing with heads of state and government, used to dealing with thorny international problems, we do it in a certain way. And what we're seeing here in terms of the art of the deal are real estate people using their practice, their process, and putting that into the diplomatic side and trying to reach a deal as if they're buying a building. I think that's part of the problem that we're watching. And I think that's what Trump was alluding to on the plane when he talked to the journalist about, well, of course, Witkoff is going over there describing how they should approach me, you know, that kind of thing. Sure, maybe in the real estate world, that's what they do. But it doesn't work so well in the diplomacy. My colleague just mentioned treason. I mean, that's how it's looked upon. And so in terms of art of the deal, we got to remember the kind of deal that's being made and the people making the deal. They play by different rules.
Indeed. James Townsend, thank you for that first opening salvo of your contribution to this debate about the situation in Ukraine and Witkoff's art of the deal or sellout. That's possibly the two ways we're interpreting what is going on. Let's take a listen to Emmanuel Macron, President of France.
While Russia was once again pretending that it was ready for peace, the past few hours have seen renewed strikes on civilian infrastructure, especially on energy facilities and on Ukrainian civilians. So on the ground, the reality is the complete opposite of seeking peace. Several participants in our meeting also reported on their direct exchanges with the Russians, particularly with President Putin. There's clearly no Russian willingness to agree a ceasefire today. And the remarks made by the Russian foreign minister in the past few hours after the Geneva talks showed this. He said that there was no willingness to discuss the so-called amended plan that emerged from the Geneva discussions.
Emmanuel Macron 100% behind Ukraine. Of course, France has signed a deal to supply some 100 Rafale jets to Ukraine over the next 10 years and saying he's 100% behind Volodymyr Zelensky every step of the way. The idea of exchanging land, part and parcel of the deal that's been put forward, seldom takes into account the fact that people actually live on the territory being negotiated. And Anastasia, I'm wondering how those people feel, because depending on who you speak to, the Donbass is all Russian-speaking, and they want to be Russian. But I've spoken to many Ukrainians who say, yes, well, they may be Russian, but they don't want to be Russian. They see themselves as Ukrainian. It's one of these grey areas that I think Kurkov, the novelist, wrote about very beautifully in Grey Bees, his book, about how things are kind of very blurred there.
Well, maybe it's going to be discovery for some, but all of Ukraine speaks Russian. Indeed, there are no Russian speakers, you know, shoveled in a corner of the east of Ukraine.
But Zelensky speaks Russian. That's his...
It's not just Zelensky. In every single region, every single person living in every single corner of Ukraine speaks perfect Russian language. Maybe with the exception of children who were born since 2022, because I don't think a lot of Ukrainians today want their children to speak Russian, but those are going to be very young representatives of the population. There are no adult non-Russian speakers in Ukraine. In this way, Donbass doesn't differ from the rest of Ukraine. It doesn't differ from the rest of Ukraine concerning all adult speakers who've gone to school since 1991, because that's when Ukrainian became official language, and hence the people of Donbass speak Ukrainian, whether they want to speak it or they don't, just like President Zelensky hasn't done any single performance in Ukrainian. And his only public speaking in Ukrainian started when he became president. He wasn't the first Ukrainian president for whom this was the case. However, this didn't, you know, make him study learn Ukrainian from scratch. He had already spoken Ukrainian. And in Kryvyi Rih, where his family comes from, which is an industrial city in the heart of Ukraine, Dnipropetrovsk region, everybody, you know, speaks Ukrainian and Russian. So just I want to really put that piece of the information and propaganda by Russia really in the corner, because we must not follow the kind of framework of thinking that is being imposed and which doesn't have anything to do with reality at all. Now, coming back to your question, what do people feel who live there, but also who don't necessarily live there? So there are several things there. First of all, you have people who have lived since 2014, now for 11 years, on the occupied territories. You have to imagine that the internet is cut. It's a Russian net, RUNET. You have to imagine that the communication is limited with their relatives, what relatives can tell them or friends on the phone, etc. What they're watching, what they're seeing, what they're viewing in terms of information space is very much controlled. Now, then secondly, these are contested territories. So, of course, these people have been constantly subject to bombardments by both sides, etc. And they understand this as well. And they are absolutely fed up. The male population is pretty much gone, missing by being recruited by Russians to fight in the war. And then you have, this is just part of the population. These people have been subject
to... When you say recruited by Russia, is that a forced situation?
Yeah, absolutely. Those people were mobilized. And as from the very start...
So they're not hands up, I will fight for Russia. It's you've got no choice.
The people were okay. Going to work like you and I, you know, are you willing to fight for anybody right now? Do you want to go and fight for, I don't know, Macron, for maybe Marine Le Pen, maybe for anyone else, for Honduras? No, you are busy doing this show, right? The same thing. People were going to work, people were living their lives, and then they were occupied. And when you're occupied, France was occupied. You know how limited your freedom is when you're occupied. Your freedom is limited. Now, then there are parts of the four regions now partly under occupation, which have been entirely destroyed. This includes the kill zone, which is now up to between 20 and 30 kilometers wide. So that would make very, very difficult to, for example, determine the line of contact, so to say, because it's no longer a line of contact. It's really a gray zone, which is actually massive, stretching for hundreds of kilometers. Now, and third, there are people who are living on the territories which are controlled by Ukrainian government. And those people are now being displaced by the advancing Russian troops or by the advancing front lines closer to their homes. Obviously, they don't want to be part of Russia. They don't want to be part of the territory which is absolutely annihilated, and they want for the war to stop, but they don't want to give up their houses and their territory to Russia, because that means they would have to move out. We've seen what Russians do when they occupy a city or a village. They kill, they shoot the man, they rape the women and the children, and they also then steal the children and bring them to Russia. So these things nobody wants to endure, and they obviously would like the war to stop, but not at the cost of giving up the land. And then you're forgetting another category of the population, which are all of the displaced, internally displaced people, all of the migrants who have left those territories they will never be able to return to anymore, how they feel, I'll let you imagine, and the warriors, the people from Ukrainian army who have seen numerous friends and brothers in arms fall in those territories and are asking themselves, what have we fought for? So this is how complex this issue is. And in Ukraine not being Russia, in essence, comes down to the precarious position of the leader of that country. The leader knows this. And the precariousness of his position, if he makes a wrong choice, can go as far as his physical security from his own people.
Indeed. Zelensky very famously, when offered a lift out of Ukraine, came up with that phrase, Ya tut, I'm here, I'm staying here, and he wants to fight. And Trump saying, you know, leave him to fight his little heart out. Well, it's something that I think Zelensky is very prepared to do. One would have hoped, Samantha, that there would be some kind of continued help. Of course, we're in a different situation now completely. As Anastasia was pointing out, populations in those areas that possibly would be swapped around in some way, shape or form have so much to lose, even if the place is destroyed.
Yes, and we see people even in Pokrovsk, which is a town that has been a lot in the headlines recently. The Russians have been trying to take it for a whole year. You even see some old people there who don't want to leave because they have nowhere to go. I think if I may just differ a little bit with Anastasia, having travelled quite a lot to Ukraine, having spoken to some of my journalist colleagues who've come back from there are some very old people in particular who have got to the point where they don't care who governs them. They just want it to stop. A lot of these are Russian speakers, and I completely agree with Anastasia. Just because you're a Russian speaker does not mean you're Russian. I speak English. I'm definitely British, and I don't belong to any other country where English is a majority language. And just as the Swiss French are definitely not French. But and in Ukraine, you also have Russian, like ethnic Russians who have been there since independence or came later, who are now in the Ukrainian army and who feel that they are Ukrainian, and they don't really speak very good Ukrainian. And that's the other thing that I would like to concur with Anastasia on, having travelled a lot throughout the whole of Ukraine. I've never met a Ukrainian who doesn't speak Russian, but I have met a few Ukrainians who don't speak very good Ukrainian, particularly some of the older generation. So this is not about language at all. I would even argue that it's not even about territory. I don't really think at the end of the day, and maybe Yuri Bondarev will disagree with me on this, but my gut feeling, this is not really about a few extra centimetres or square kilometres of Ukrainian land. This is about controlling Ukraine. And I fear that in a negotiation, Putin may pretend to make some territorial concessions and say, OK, maybe I don't want the whole of Zaporizhia and Kherson oblasts, even though they have actually been incorporated into the Russian Federation, according to Russian law. I'm willing to relinquish that in my magnanimity. I'm even really willing to relinquish maybe Kramatorsk or Slavyansk, which are in Donetsk. And this will be seen as a great gesture of generosity, but he will insist on crappy security guarantees, on snap elections, which he will then really try to infiltrate with his whole disinformation arsenal. And his aim is to control Ukraine with a puppet regime and slowly turn it into a new Belarus. So I think what the danger in the negotiations are fake territorial concessions from Russia, with a very dangerous situation for Ukraine. And I think if I were negotiating on the Ukrainian side, and Anastasia, please don't shoot me after the show, but I would be inclined to making some territorial concessions on the condition that I have ironclad security guarantees from NATO, from the EU, and ironclad assistance in making sure that I have a very robust way to fight cyber warfare and disinformation warfare coming from Russia, and very, very fast integration into the EU and some kind of Europe-wide security structure, whether or not it's NATO, I think that's beside the point. But that's what I think this is really about, and that's what I think we Westerners should realize that this is about, that the territory which is lost, and Zelensky said so himself a year ago, he feels that there are parts of Donbass region and also parts of Crimea that have been occupied for so long that even if they got the territories back, getting the people back, i.e. the people who live there now, because many people have been moved from Russia into those regions, would be much more difficult. I don't think he'll ever agree to relinquish them forever, but I think there could be a fudge on what happens to these territories, because he knows how difficult it will be to integrate them emotionally back into Ukraine at this point.
I know Anastasia wants to talk, but I have to stop you, Anastasia, because I've got to go to Boris in Geneva, Boris Bondarev, former Russian diplomat. Boris, I know you've been following what Samantha was just saying there. This issue of territory, what is your sense on that?
I think that this is to some extent artificially inflated. I mean, the importance of territory, and some people start to think that it is the first question, the most important question of all settlement. But I think that it is not. It's more like a decoy. So, and while people will be discussing territorial concessions, then other more important questions, like no security guarantees to Ukraine, like infiltration, as Amanda mentioned, infiltration of Russian propaganda machine into Ukrainian information space, infiltration of pro-Putin politicians in Ukraine. Those issues could be neglected and allowed into some text of the final settlement. And then, of course, I believe that Putin is not that flexible to discuss any territorial concessions eventually. And taking into account that he shows no genuine signs of getting into real negotiations in goodwill, he's still hoping that he can prevail on the battlefield. And Russian troops are still advancing slowly at great cost, but they are advancing and they are taking and seizing more and more territories. So he will be, I think, most likely will be just playing time and expecting that during these fake negotiations, like he did in May with this new round of Istanbul consultations, right? He will just have enough time to pursue his luck on battlefield. With each day, which is each square kilometer occupied, he will strengthen his position, he will weaken Ukrainian position, and then he will be talking to everybody as ultimate victor. So I think that is his grand design. So I wouldn't expect that Russia will go into consultations or negotiations on this particular peace proposal, seriously.
Indeed. Boris, thank you very much indeed. Let's go back to James Townsend. joining us from the US, former Deputy Assistant to the US Secretary of Defense regarding Europe and NATO matters. Just remind people as well, James, before I set you loose, Vladimir Putin wanted for war crimes regarding the snatching of some 20,000 or more. I see different figures all the time, but it's a substantial thousands of Ukrainian children taken into Russia to be, in for want of a better word, re-educated into a different culture that isn't theirs. And that's obviously something that has been mentioned as part of the deal of getting those children back, but that might be easier said than done. And once again, coming back to Witkoff and his out of the deal or sellout, depending on how we want to interpret what he's been doing, it all seems all the more distasteful, does it not, given Putin's standing, given what's happened, given what's at stake?
Well, that's something that is another part of this deal that there's not a lot of focus on, and it is about the humanitarian aspects. It's about reconstruction. You know, it's one thing that's interesting about the children is that's been something that Melania Trump, President Trump's wife, has taken up personally between herself and Putin. So for Donald Trump, he's got to pay attention to that because he's got a partner there who's very interested in that as well. But we really haven't seen a lot of focus on that. And the war crimes aspect is something that is going to set a precedent from now on. If that is waived as part of the of a peace deal, that's going to have ramifications into all the gains that the West has made since World War II in terms of humanitarian things and in terms of the World Court and the ICC and all kinds of justice infrastructure that has been erected to try to keep war crimes at bay. And so if this is just waved away without commentary, just as a part of the peace deal, that will be a loss to society, to the culture of the West that we've developed since learning the lessons of World War II. So there's some things at stake here, and you point out that this is going to be hard to do. This is going to be something that is probably unprecedented. I'm not sure where this has happened in the past, where we've been able to reunite families the way that at the scale that we see with Ukraine and Russia. So that's going to be difficult to do, just even if we were able to get agreement within the treaty to do that kind of unification of those families. So there's a lot at stake that hasn't been discussed yet, but are really important for precedent, as well as for the humanitarian tragedy that has unfolded since 2014, and that we need to really make sure is in there some way or another. It's important.
James, thank you very much indeed. Anastasia, can you give us 10 seconds, literally 10 seconds, final comment? Go ahead.
What we are observing is a profanation of foreign policy by America and a political suicide, a public political suicide on a mass scale.
Anastasia, we've got to leave it there. I'm sorry, there's so much more to talk about. Anastasia Shaposhkina of Eastern Circles, thank you for joining us. Samantha Benden of Chatham House, as always, great to see you. Thanks to our guests joining us from afar. Boris Bondarev in Geneva, former Russian diplomat. Thank you, Boris, for your insight. And thank you to James Townsend, who joined us late but contributed so much. Thank you, sir. James Townsend, former Deputy Assistant to the US Secretary of Defense regarding Europe and NATO. Thanks to you all for watching. Stay with us here in France 24.